Everyone likes barbecue. Supersized slabs of juicy ribs cooked over a wood fire until the meat slides right off the bone. Smoky pulled pork sandwiches with a side of homemade coleslaw. Food doesn't get much more American than barbecue. It's part of our roots, and it's also tangled up in our racial history. But today, barbecue is undergoing a renaissance. Young people are ditching careers on Wall Street to become pit masters. Barbecue fanatics will drive hundreds of miles just to eat smoked ribs off a paper plate in a shack by the side of the road. And if you're thinking, well, anyone can stick a chicken on a backyard grill, that's not barbecue.
Barbecue is a marriage of smoke and meat and time and expertise. It's that simple. I mean, it's the most elemental of American foods, and yet it's not a simple food. To cook great barbecue requires great knowledge, a long time in the pits, and a deep understanding of your clientele as well.
John T. Edge is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And you notice the one thing he didn't mention? Barbecue sauce. So, okay, I'm a northerner, but when most people up here in the north think about barbecue, they think, yeah, sauce.
Well, bless their hearts.
Come on, really? Don't you have to have sauce? You go to stores, you see all those jars of, you know, so-and-so's famous sauce. Then there's the other more famous sauce.
Sure. And sauce is a great gilding of the barbecue lily. It's not the primary event. Sauce is a way to define barbecue geography, and it serves us in that way. But sauce is, you know, what you apply after you've done all this hard work. It's not the hard work.
What do you mean when you say sauce defines barbecue geography?
So you can map the South by way of sauce. A generation ago, a geographer from the University of South Carolina, a guy named Charles Kovacic, developed a barbecue sauce map of South Carolina. And he isolated county by county how sauces varied, from vinegar-based sauces on the eastern flank to mustard-based sauces in the center, and sweeter, kind of redder sauces, ketchup-based sauces as you move further west. And that was just South Carolina that he defined by way of geographical overlay of sauce. You could do that for the whole of the South, and South Carolina is kind of a microcosm of that.
Wow. It's like barbecue is an actual language.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a way for Southerners to communicate, most certainly. Barbecue is its own sort of language.
Is this why I've read that you've described barbecue as our national folk food?
I think it is. It is this kind of cultural product that we all recognize. Say the words barbecue, and people recognize the form. Their mouths begin to water. And they also begin talking about the differences. So the superstructure is barbecue is American. Beneath that, barbecue is Southern. Beneath that, barbecue is local. Each layer of that conversation is interesting, but those conversations all add up to this notion that barbecue is our great American folk food.
Hmm. Now, you've argued that we're entering a new golden age of barbecue, that there's, I don't know, a barbecue renaissance or something going on. What's happening?
There are two things happening. One, a new generation of Americans recognizes the value in kind of elemental American foods. Hamburgers, fried chicken, hot dogs, apple pie, barbecue. Whereas before they might have aspired to eating French food or Italian food or Japanese food more recently, now people aspire to American food, both as eaters and as cooks of that food. There's a new value ascribed to that food that wasn't the case before.
So are you saying that, like, in the culinary world, the world of, you know, James Beard Awards and expensive restaurants, in that world, barbecue is becoming more recognized or quote-unquote respectable?
Yeah, I think across the entire dining spectrum. I mean, if you take the James Beard Awards as an example, this year, for the first time, a barbecue pitmaster was nominated for Best Chef Southwest. And it was amazing that barbecue pitmaster, Aaron Franklin of Franklin's Barbecue in Austin, Texas, was nominated. Even more amazing, Aaron Franklin won that award, beating out a host of white tablecloth chefs. That says something about this American moment.
So who are some of the barbecue greats right now? I mean, who are the, I don't know, the Thomas Kellers or the Alice Waters of barbecue today?
One of the most respected is a gentleman named Rodney Scott. And Rodney is in Hemingway, South Carolina, in the PD region of that state. Rodney, when you talk to him about what he does, and Rodney cooked his first pig when he was 11 years old. Rodney grew up in a farming family, a family that had a country store out in the sticks just beyond the city of Hemingway. And when you talk to Rodney about what he does, he'll talk to you about going out in the woods to chop his own trees. The interesting thing about what Rodney says about cooking barbecue is that when he goes out and chops down his own trees to cook his barbecue, he compares it to a chef going out in the garden to pick his own tomato.
Farm to table. This is woods to table.
It is. It's completely.
That's great. So here's one guy who, from the sound of it, you know, grew up on this tradition. But there are others you've written about. Like there's a guy named Tyson Ho who runs Arrogant Swine in Brooklyn. And from what I've read, he gave up a career in finance to become a pit master.
Yeah, I think Tyson Ho is really interesting. He's on the kind of industrial fringe of Brooklyn and gave up a career in finance. Tyson Ho said to me that he chose to cook barbecue because this is the oldest style of American cooking. He wanted to cook barbecue because that was his way of claiming his Americanness. Tyson Ho is a child of Asian immigrants. And in cooking barbecue, he was claiming his Americanness. Tyson Ho was saying to me that by way of cooking barbecue, he was claiming an American past that was just as much his as someone who came over on the Mayflower. And he said it with pride, not with indignation. He said it with pride. And he recognized that barbecue was that kind of pathway to American identity. And that was the one he chose, that he left behind finance and barbecue was his way. Plus, the barbecue's pretty darn good.
Does barbecue get racially complicated? Because I've seen old photos of, you know, big barbecue events, and you see a bunch of white guys who basically are supervising or pretending to supervise a bunch of African-American guys who are actually the ones doing the cooking.
Right. That's the kind of WPA-era photo you always see of an African-American man tending the pit while a white fellow in suspenders and a big Panama hat as he gazes upon the work of the African-American man. And that has typically been the way it's portrayed. The reality is something different. There's a real hinge in American history. You know, it's pegged at like the late 1920s, early 1930s, when if you look at the literature and the references to barbecue, you see in that moment that African-American men begin to be referred to as pit masters.
And I suppose the second half of that word is interesting, pit masters.
Yeah, it is. The notion that an African-American man who until the 1860s was considered a slave, and now that man is considered a master. He's the master of his job, of his domain, is garnered, you know, garners respect because of his work, and that man is now called a master is a heck of a pivot, you know, comparatively short amount of time.
So is barbecue widely regarded as an African-American tradition? Because I thought there are also places in the country where there's sort of some debate or conflict over whether barbecue is black or white.
I don't think barbecue is black. I don't think barbecue is white. I think barbecue is uniquely American. I think our culture is an amalgam of influences. I do think, though, that because of the peculiar racial history of this nation, we've long kind of failed to recognize the expertise of African-American pitmasters. What we're doing now is kind of paying down a debt of pleasure to the past and to those old guard pitmasters. That's where we stand now.
What do you mean, pay down a debt of pleasure?
Well, if you think about, I don't know, for me, I grew up a half mile from a barbecue joint. I knew the name of the owner, and I knew the name of the woman that stood behind the counter and chopped the meat. But I recognize, looking back, that I didn't know the name of all those men who worked those pits. And by way of making films about this with the Southern Foodways Alliance or writing, one of the things that I'm attempting to do with my work is pay down a debt of pleasure to say thank you. And one of the ways to say thank you is by way of offering earned recognition that has been long been defrayed.
Hmm. So has barbecue played a role in the history of race in America or racial politics?
Yes. One of the signal battles of the civil rights movement was staged at a barbecue restaurant. Ollie's Barbecue in Birmingham, Alabama, was one of the signal court cases wherein Ollie McClung and his family refused to integrate their restaurant. They would serve African Americans at the rear, and their employees were almost exclusively African American, and yet they chose not to serve African Americans in the dining room. That story is told numerous locales across the South, at Vandy's Barbecue in Statesboro, Georgia, at Ayers Log Cabin in rural North Carolina. These restaurants, these barbecue restaurants, were some of the last holdouts in integration in the American South. And for many of those white owners, they couched this in terms of property rights and said, this is my restaurant, and I treat my restaurant like my home, and I get to control who enters and who exits. Of course, that did not hold up after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and restaurants were forced to integrate. But the argument that my restaurant is my home was the one they made, the one they stood behind, and the one that did not serve them well in the end. We think of barbecue and barbecue restaurants as this great democratic institution, small d democratic institution, and we should. And yet, for the longest time, they failed to live up to their principles. And since the 1960s, that's been corrected. Now you see a kind of integrated South communing at the tables of barbecue restaurants, which is the way the food was conceived and executed and what was intended. And that's, to me, great progress and is another reason that barbecue serves us as this kind of folk food. It was a problematic food set back on the right path. And that's one of the reasons that kind of tension, the knowledge that comes with that kind of tension, the knowledge of barbecue's past, is one of the reasons that I enjoy communing there now, to think about a broken institution now righted and fixed, a broken institution now celebrated, a broken institution now rich and vibrant and progressive.
So does that make it complicated at all for you as a white guy going to and sitting down at a traditional barbecue joint?
To think about that past?
Yeah.
If you're not aware of that past, you're not fully appreciating the moment. To know that past makes your experience richer. So it's not problematic for me. What would be problematic is not knowing that history. To understand where that place came from and to understand that, like, you know, the American Republic, you know, stumbling fitfully towards democracy and inclusiveness, barbecue reflects the same kind of failures and hopefully a path towards success, a path towards inclusiveness. I'm working on a book now it starts in 1960 with the lunch counter sit-ins and moves forward. Southern food, I believe, began to really matter for reasons emotional, intellectual, political in the 1960s. And one of the reasons we're seeing this renaissance in Southern food in general and barbecue in particular is that it has this crazy, beautiful, tragic resonance. And if we understand the stories behind it, it makes clear what that resonance is. You kind of feel it, you sense it. You understand somehow that Southern food matters and that it's different from other regional cuisines. But when you tell those stories, you recognize why. You recognize why you're attracted to it and repelled by it at the same time. That's what Southern food does.
John T. Edge is one of the great chroniclers of Southern food. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer who's written books about apple pie, fried chicken, and donuts. He also runs the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi's Center for the Study of Southern Culture.